Hello and welcome to the One Way to Do It podcast, presented by Genius Move Audio Academy. My name is Paul Brewer, and in this podcast, I chat to audio professionals about their skills. Please visit geniusmove.ie for more details on the Academy. Today's guest is Simon Saywood. I was introduced to him by Mike Banks of SSL when Simon worked as a maintenance engineer at Metropolis Studio. Simon owns a company called Analog Tube that builds Fairchild 660 and 670 compressor clones, amongst other products. We sat down for a chat over the internet, where I started by asking him, was he still employed by Metropolis? Do you still work in Metropolis, where we met in, was it 2008 or 9 or whatever it was?
Well, not anymore, actually. I mean, I was at Metropolis sort of, I suppose, from what you would call the early days, from sort of 97 onwards, up until sort of 3.5, 4 years ago. So I was there for a good 23 years.
Wow.
Sort of teching for the studios. Yeah. So it was quite a journey, actually, just because of the sort of transformation of all the technology that was in the industry that's been going on and continues to.
Were you part of a team, or were you a solo?
We were, actually, and sort of part of a team that rostered, if I can put it like that, at sort of various times of the day. So we'd have a sort of a shift where some of us would start at 9 in the morning and leave at 6, and then others would sort of start at 3 and then leave at 12. But in those days, you know, in the early days, there was much more of a need, I think, for technical staff, because people were setting up tape machines back in those days. There was Dolby, of course, and there was a whole bunch of other hands-on stuff that needed sort of looking after, really. But it sort of seems so, perhaps in a slightly different way today, but less so, if you see what I mean.
You were a technician in what you might term the good old days, yeah?
I'm not going to be that guy. But
well, absolutely not.
Well, although...
But you know what I'm saying, Like, the need for technicians has definitely dropped, hasn't it?
Well, it has in some instances. Of course, a lot of what people still record through in the bigger studios, like Metropolis and Abbey Road, still have large format consoles. So there's a huge need for the support of those consoles, you know, for Neves, for... perhaps more so the Neves, you know, for the Neve VRs, for instance. Increasingly so, perhaps, for the K-Series consoles, which sort of followed on from there. So, you know, the SSL K-Series consoles. So this stuff doesn't go on forever.
Yeah.
And, of course, it does need more support. But, of course, there's also backline support. There's microphone repairs. Outboard gear repairs. There's all of this. So kind of the support has sort of shifted around a little bit, whereas, you know, in the early days, it was a lot of the work was simply shifting tape machines around, which were sort of 250 kilos each.
Yes.
And setting them up.
Yes. I seem to remember seeing something on Facebook about Neve Honey. Is that stuff from the Transformers that melt or something? Which I'd never heard of before. I only heard about it recently, and that was called Neve Honey.
That sounds more like a catastrophe, actually, more than, I don't know, but I mean, some of these, well, I mean, I can really only speak for the Neve VR, because that's the one that sort of that Metropolis had, but certainly the power supplies for these things, you know, you'd be looking at sort of 16 volt rails of 50 amps each, and these things get hot, you know, and we're talking kilowatts. Separate storage for these things, air conditioning. The SSLs are the same, you know, the 9K series consoles are the same, you know. They're massively power hungry. And once the aircon goes off, which it does from time to time, we've all had experiences with that at the studio, things rapidly become very warm, you know, and that's when it's time to switch off.
Right.
Or fix the air conditioning.
Yeah. Before Metropolis, where did you work? What's your sort of technical background? Where did you decide to get involved in this?
It's sort of a bit of a long story, really. I kind of moved away from, my parents lived in the, shall we say, the home counties, and I moved out of home when I was 24, 25, something like that. And I moved into a flat in Cambridge, and I worked for a lab company that made instrumentation equipment for schools and universities and colleges, sort of measuring equipment, basically. So they made galvanometers, they made Wheatstone bridges and stuff basically for education. But I didn't really realize it at the time. You know, I was very keen to get into electronics. My father worked for Marconi's in Chelmsford in the early days.
So did my dad.
Right. Okay.
Unbelievably.
Okay. Well, I mean, well, you know what? There's probably another story there. You know, that's kind of where my interest sort of came from, really. And I was forever sort of. I suppose it's sort of a typical story of sort of learning, I guess. But as a kid, a child, you know, you kind of thirst for knowledge. For any generation is sort of always about taking things apart, just never putting stuff back together again, and just basically finding out how stuff works. And I ended up with this manufacturing company, which is funny because if I look back on it 25 years later or so on, I've sort of gone a bit full circle, really. And I was always interested in music. I mean, I don't know what kid isn't interested in music. So I think that's what sort of led me, you know, down the path into Willesden Green, actually, which is Battery Studios. So my first job in the industry was at Dream Hire, which was a sort of a music rental company.
Yes.
Yeah. So and that was...
It was the music rental company for a while, wasn't it?
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, there were a couple of others. I was there for about 7 or 8 years, something like that. And then I left there and went to work at HHB Communications, and that was great. And I was there for about 18 months, and I headed up their service department there. So it was kind of a slightly different job from what I was used to before. It was more of a sort of a desk job, I suppose. And then I took a few months out after I left there, and then I went to Metropolis Studios, and that's kind of where it stopped for 23 years. And I was there looking after everything that Metropolis has got to offer.
Was that around when Metropolis started? Is that when you got involved? Or?
So, 97, I joined Metropolis in Chiswick, and I think they'd been running for a couple of years before. So I suppose you could say it was sort of in the early days, the mastering side of it had been established. So I think the rooms on the top floor were sort of moved in the sort of intervening years before I arrived to where they are now. I think that became Studio E, or what it is now. So, which has got the K-Series in, the 72 input K-Series.
Was all the equipment there, or?
Actually, that's an interesting question, because I think a lot of what you see at the studio has been there for an awfully long time. Key thing about it is that it's been really good. And that's important, because good gear for me will always sort of stand the test of time. You know, if somebody likes it, then it'll be around for, you know, forever. It won't be replaced. It won't be not much, I suppose, to sort of challenge, you know, really, really good gear. It's just become the sort of accepted sort of standard. You know, a lot of the Summit Audio stuff, which was there before I arrived, still used today in mastering. That's always been sort of Metropolis's sort of goal, really, to sort of have the best. So, you know, they wouldn't have to buy, you know, if new stuff comes along and it does something different and it's equally as good and sounds great, then fine, you add to it. But, you know, for a lot of this stuff, it's been there and it's still being used now, which is brilliant, actually. It's really, really good. And it's a sort of real testament to the manufacturers.
And in terms of a business approach, an investment, it's worth it for that point of view then as well, because it's going to last you 25 years or 30 years, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, some of the sort of EQP 100s, again, you know, the Summits, hugely expensive at the time, incredibly expensive now, if you can find it. It's an investment. You know, gear, you find that increasingly these days with people buying gear as for, you know, for investments. I think that sort of, I suppose that's always been my sort of approach, really, to make it as good as you can and then not have to worry about it. I mean, it sounds a very grandiose thing to say, and I don't know what to say about that, but I just feel from a manufacturing point of view, I know from working in a manufacturer is that it's not great to have stuff back. Of course, stuff breaks, and we live in a technical industry, and you know, stuff happens. But ultimately, you really want to try and make it as good as you can. And for me, because I'm a one-man band, I don't employ any staff, and I have done it in the past, for my sort of manufacturing side of things, it would be sort of also very difficult for me to, you know, to have stuff back to repair, not least because of, you know, the weight and size of the stuff, really. I mean, it's colossal. It's not sort of small rack-mounted bits of gear which you can stick in a cardboard box, you know. So I have to... Yeah,
it's a pallet.
Yeah, but essentially, yes, it's a pallet, and kind of from my early days of working in manufacturing to repairing stuff for Dream Hire, repairing their backline stuff, I've always been quite keen on doing that sort of side of things as best as it can be done. I mean, you know, I mean, not least when stuff goes out for live use, you know, if it's going to break, it's going to break. You need to really make sure that it's actually not going to do that and that it is actually going to work when you switch it on. So, and that's always been my sort of philosophy, really.
When did you come across a Fairchild, and how was that then, the idea of developing that into a business, come from? Which Analog Tube is now, isn't that
yes,
correct?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, the company was, I think, formalized. I think that's the correct term in 2000 and in December of 2007, I think. The idea behind this, I was 40 at the time, and I was thinking, well, you know, am I going to be working in a studio for the rest of my life? Things about one sort of future that you think about, and you think, well, you know, what am I actually going to be doing? You know, because 67 is not that far away. I'm becoming tired. I'm becoming more grumpy, more irritable.
Describing me.
Yeah. So I had to sort of take the reins a bit, really, and sort of think quite hard about, our two children had arrived. And I had to think sort of quite seriously about, you know, what my future looks like. And actually, it was sort of quite fortuitous, really. I mean, I'd heard of Fairchild, obviously, before I arrived at Metropolis, but Metropolis actually had one. And I thought, well, what is there in 2002 that people love, people rave about, and can people, you know, are people going to be able to afford this sort of type of equipment? You know, we're moving into the digital age at this stage. You know, what's the sort of relevance of all this sort of gear? And I had to think quite long and hard about all of that, because I wasn't really in a position to make lots of different bits of gear. I didn't have the capacity to do it. You know, I was still working sort of 7 days a week and working at the weekend and stuff. So I had to think about the development of a product that could really, I suppose, make a change or something that was sort of significant. And Metropolis had a Fairchild. It was a sort of bit of a doorstep, really. So I thought, well, I'm going to fix this. It was a broken Fairchild, and it was propping a door open down the end of the sort of tech corridor. And I thought, well, why? Let's have a look at this at the weekend, you know, and see what's going on. And I kind of realised quite quickly that there were bits missing from it,
and like valves or
well,
or
yeah, right. So or... so of course, all of that side of it was missing. The transformers were missing from it. So what has sort of typically happened to these original units over the years is that the control output transformers have been cooked for whatever reason, that one of them's died and they've stopped working. So the side chain stopped working. And also I think there were some audio output transformers were missing from it as well. So I thought, well, this thing's got to be rebuilt. I had to rewire it because a lot of the wiring had become sort of decayed, and it's old PVC wiring in these original units, and a lot of it sort of cloth wiring as well. And over the years, the plastic has decayed a bit, and you pull this stuff apart, which has been loomed up inside the unit, and it just all, you know, you just end up stripping the wire out. So it's not great. So I had that to sort of consider as well. And I just saw it as a sort of, I thought, right, well, there's a bit of a challenge here. And I really, really loved to find out. I kind of really keen to find out what everybody was talking about, you know, why it did what it did, how it did it, and just sort of essentially the way it sort of performed. And that's kind of where it all sort of started from, really. And I rebuilt it using Souter transformers and kept the originals that were there and just replaced the ones that needed replacing. I built my development unit alongside the repair of this unit. So I built it with all the sort of empirical values so that I knew exactly, there was very little tolerance in the components used, obviously, as there is with normal vintage Fairchilds. We're looking at 10% resistors. The way I built this one, my development unit, was all using 1% resistors. So I kind of really wanted to dive into the sort of performance of this unit and see how it behaved. I had a sort of an empirical idea of its performance.
That 1% thing would mean consistency between models and stuff then, I guess, as well.
Well, yes, I mean...
Or is there too many variables?
In its original version, obviously a lot of the tolerance values were quite broad, except around the metering circuit. But all of them are like sort of 10% carbon resistors. The idea behind building a development unit alongside it was to build it exactly how this one was built, but using sort of 1% value resistors to keep the noise down. My idea was to sort of find out exactly how it worked so that I could sort of null out any, could the circuit be improved? Could we change some resistor values somewhere? I mean, as it happens, actually nothing's changed. I ended up just building it the way I did back then to this day. So nothing has actually changed at all. So, but it was a curiosity that I wanted to find out how it performed accurately with these new components in. And that was quite interesting, really.
So at the end of it, you had a repaired original and your new gadget.
Yes, that's right.
And how did they compare, or what was the...
This was an extraordinary moment, actually, I have to say, because the only difference between the original unit and my development unit was, I mean, there was a few other things, we could talk about that, but later. But the only sort of component difference were the component manufacturers of the transformers. So I used Souters. You know, I contacted Brian Souter over this, and he'd been selling his versions of the input-output, control-input, and control-output transformer for these units for quite a number of years by this stage for people who are interested in, sort of, I suppose, exactly what I was doing at the time. So I took that kind of leap of faith, and I've stuck with it ever since, really. So there were no changes. All the same tubes, essentially all the same transformers, all the same components, all the same wiring, all the same metering. Everything about it was sort of mimicked, I suppose, against the original versions. I've added a few bells and whistles along the way. I've never taken anything away from it. And that's been possible because essentially the Fairchild is sort of two amplifiers that can be separated easily. Well, in my case, through the use of relays and so on. So it's been, you know, it's been a relatively sort of simple process to make it more functional.
I obviously haven't heard one of these, but I've heard the legend. You know, there's so many tubes, there's so many transformers in it. Is it completely different than everything else? Is that what's going on? Or why does it sound so good? And does it sound so good?
Well, do you know what? Actually, Paul, it's interesting. This morning, I was just doing a quick total of the number of versions that there are at the moment. And for me, the original sort of version of this, I'm looking down my list of sort of 8 or 9 different models here. I've got the ADL670, which sort of championed all of this back in the 90s, which is Anthony DiMario's unit. There then came the Unfairchild Mark I. There then came Drip Electronics, which was just a PCB. There was POM Audio. More recently, there's Heritage Audio. There's Stam Audio. There's the a company that fell by the wayside who doesn't have a domain anymore, which is Keats Audio. I don't know who they've become, if they have. There's the Fairman TMC tube mastering compressor. All of these units were mimicking the 670, if I can put it like that. As we all are, we're all trying to get to the sort of the key of the original sort of the original format.
The Holy Grail.
The Holy Grail. And there are a lot of manufacturers. I mean, obviously, there's Manley, there's Pendulum Audio, there's Gates, there's all of these companies that follow a similar path. The process of very mute compression is not a new thing. What is it about the Fairchild 660 and 670 that sort of gave it its signature? And that was one of the reasons why I built in the early days a sort of a parallel unit to the one I'd repaired, so that I could find out exactly why it did what it did and how it did that. And that's what I found really interesting, actually. And I looked into this quite a bit, actually. It's funny about that list of sort of manufacturers, because some of them have used different tubes, different remote cutoff tubes. Some of them use different parts of the circuit and use solid state alternatives. And there's a whole sort of combination of units out there that are sort of an interpretation, I suppose, of the original. Because one of the difficult things about historical technology is that it's impossible to bottle. You can't bottle 70 years of history. It's just in audio. You just can't. I would like to say, of course, that mine sounds as close to the original as possible. But in essence, how could it? You're making a claim to something which is past now, and you can't change that. You know, there are all sorts of things about historical technology that make it very difficult to reclaim, if I can put it like that.
Is that because you can't compare it to when it was new? Is that the problem?
Yeah, that's the issue. You can't go back in time, you know.
Right.
And that was my reason for making one of these units as an empirical unit. So I wanted to know, you know, I wanted to know as close to 1959 as I could get how it would sound. But obviously I'm using different transformers at this stage, using different tubes, actually, even though they're replacements of the same thing, I'm using different tubes. And again, all of this sort of lends itself to the color and character of the music that we put through it. So it's quite a difficult. All you can do is hope. Hope that people like it.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. So, like, ultimately, when you did your comparison test to the repaired unit and your new unit, there wasn't a significant difference? Where's the magic coming from, do you think?
Well, one of the key things for me is that the original unit is very transparent, hugely so, and you can just use it as a line amplifier without any compression or limiting going on whatsoever. It sounds wonderful. It sounds really clean. That's my interpretation of how a Fairchild or 660 or 670 should sound. And that was my comparison. And my comparison to the development units sounded, to my ears, it sounded very nice. It sounded super clean. It sounded super transparent. And I thought, well, that's it. That's the thing. That's what's going on here. Performance-wise, the way Fairchild's 660s and 670s behave, not in a kind of a linear compression sense. It behaves a little bit like a bandpass compressor, if I can put it like that. I mean, obviously, a bandpass compressor is like an extreme thing. But if you look at the sort of the spectrum of audio compression on a 660 and 670, and you really start to sort of drive the sidechain, you'll see that the spectrum of audio is not a flat line. You know, there's a dip in the kind of the mid area, and it becomes more pronounced the harder you drive it. And what that is saying is that it's leaving all the top end and all the bottom end unprocessed, but all the mid stuff from 500 hertz to 5K slightly dipped. And that's where the magic is. And a lot of people, for me, that's where the magic is, that it's performance. And so you often hear a lot of people talk about these compressors adding sparkle and something in some sense is unquantifiable. I mean, that's perhaps like an image thing, but in terms of actual tone, its sparkle is left unprocessed, and it's basically all the original program, the cymbals, the snares, all the kind of the top end, the attacks of stuff is just left as it was uncompressed. And that applies also to the low end as well. I mean, I'm giving you an extreme. If you compared a bandpass compressor to a Fairchild, they're not the same thing. But if you drive a Fairchild 660 and 670, you'll begin to see that the middle is dipped out and it's dipped down. There's a reason for it.
Yeah, indeed. The original designers designed it to do that. Was that the plan, or did that they fall upon this, or how do you think that?
Well, you know, Paul, that's another interesting question, actually, because when I launched this, I launched it at the time. So there were a couple of things going on. So I was involved a little bit in the development of the 6386 tube, which thus far had been unavailable, still is, with a company in Slovakia, and in 2002, when all of this sort of started, and I was sort of wondering what I was going to be doing in my later years.
Dotage.
Oh yeah, that's what I didn't say it, but anyway, in that time, I was thinking, well, there's a bit of an Achilles heel to all of this, because it's all very well me, you know, making one of these fabulous units and making it as best as you can, but like, if you can't get the tubes, then we're done for, really. And it was a bit of a race against the clock, actually, because I did my first exhibition at the AES in San Francisco, which was the 125th AES in 2008. And I remember it well because my booth number was 440, which I thought was another kind of was another sign that things were either not going to go well or were going to go well. So I thought, we'll deal with that. So I took my unit along, and at that time, I'd spent probably up to about 6 years pestering this company in Slovakia to make a new 6386 tube. And I didn't know what I was going to do if I didn't have these things at the show, because I just would have spent 9,000 quid on a show and have nothing to exhibit. And it was all going to be a bit of a waste of time. So I thought, well, right, My philosophy is, if you can afford to lose it, just do it. And then I did it. And that's always been my sort of thing, really, to sort of, if you really like something and really enjoy it and really want to do it, if you can afford it and not worry about the cost afterwards, just go ahead and do it. And if it makes you happy. And at the end of the day, if things didn't work out at the show, I'd always have something I could sell. So that was the reason, I suppose, for me doing the show. It's a real chase up to 2008, because I was 6 months away for shipping everything out. I still didn't have these tubes from Slovakia, and I knew they were making them, and I knew they were sending me some handmade tubes. But I'm thinking, well, I've got to have something to present at the show as well as my own unit. How's this going to work? Literally 6 weeks before I was due to leave and get on that plane and go out to the show, they sent me a whole bunch of tubes, which I'd spent a lot of time probably at this kitchen table I'm talking from now, checking, evaluating, sending all the data back to them. They'd send me some more tubes, and all of these tubes at this stage were all handmade. There was very little in the world way of sort of mechanization that would make tubes consistent in any way. So they were actually hand-making them, which I found even more extraordinary, really. So it was those tubes that I took to the show. That's just an amazing achievement, to actually be able to do this, to make the statistics of this, the data of this tube change ever so slightly from the ones that I'd sent back that sort of needed to be different in some way. So, and they did all of that, and we just kept exchanging data, and we kept exchanging tubes right up to almost the show. And I could see something was happening, and it was those that I took to the show that I had in the back of my development unit that I put audio through for everybody to come and listen to. So it was they're quite heady days back then.
When you're talking about changes, we're talking tonal changes and how they react in the circuit, is it? That sort of...
Well, there's two things there. So tonal changes, yes, but I suppose more importantly, performance changes. The way these tubes are made is sort of slightly different to your regular sort of 12X7 that you might find in a guitar amp or something like that. So the differences between those and this type of tube is they're three element tubes, so they're a triode. So there's two triodes in each sort of envelope or tube, if you like. The middle elements of the tube, which is called the grid, is wound in a different way to allow a much higher voltage to cut off the tube. There's one thing about Fairchild compressors, they have a very high voltage sidechain, and it's the way the grid is wound. So it's much narrower at the sides, a sort of concentric coil of wire within remote cutoff tubes, that that coil of wire is not consistent in spacing. So the adjacent wires along the grid are spaced out more in the middle than they are at the sides. It's a bit of a technical challenge. I know JJ Electronics had to develop some machinery for it in order to sort of achieve this particular type of tube. So it was those, the handmade ones, that I actually took to the show. But that's kind of the performance difference side of it. Tonally wise, that's another story, really. I mean, lots of people say that we take examples of black plate tubes sound better than grey plate tubes. The construction of the tube changes everything, of course. The way the tubes are made, all of this sort of conspires towards a tonal change and performance of the tube. But one of the key things for me is the chemistry within the tube that changes the tone. So, like I was saying earlier, it's very difficult to sort of bottle 70 years of history. And some people say the tone of these tubes is slightly different compared to the originals. It's difficult to say, really, because the construction of the tube is slightly different. It's a slightly larger tube. The original ones were smaller. The cocktail of chemicals used within the cathode and the plate will be different from the 1950s. And that is a kind of, there's a big X there. I mean,
there's no way of knowing what a 70-year-old tube's like.
No, it's very difficult. And of course, a lot of these chemicals are banned, you know, so there's lots of legislation now to say that you can't use certain chemicals within tubes. So that also conspires towards change and, you know, change in tone of things. Certainly that is sort of one element of change within those tubes, is the chemistry. But we just hope, you know, we all hope that we're in the right sort of ballpark, really. I don't know what the sort of the ingredients for, it's a highly guarded secret, and there will be no tube manufacturers that will tell that, because that's kind of the key to their success with the tube. So yeah, it's a bit of a closely guarded secret, really, I guess, within tube manufacturers.
Which adds to the mystery of the unit as well.
Well, totally. But I mean, this is the same for all sorts of tubes, you know, for 12AX7s, for 6BA6s, for, you know, the millions of different types of valve that there are out there. They will all have slightly different characteristics and slightly different tonal characteristics, you know, when they're used for audio.
The fact that you had sort of essentially custom-made tubes, was that a marketing advantage, do you think? Or?
It was certainly an advantage for me getting my unit to the show, because without them, I'd be completely, completely done for, really.
But nobody else has access to those, did they?
No one had access to them, and I was the first person at that show to launch them. So I launched two products, essentially. So I launched the compressor that I'd built in parallel with the original one at Metropolis. I had that at the show, and I also launched the JJ Electronics 6386 tubes. So there were two things going on there, and I remember there was a big sort of, it all became sort of slightly quite busy at booth 440 for a few days, because people had not seen this before. You know, there were lots of people coming up to me saying, oh, wow, you know, you've managed to do this. It wasn't a single-handed thing. It wasn't just me. I think there were some other manufacturers involved, but I just happened to draw the short straw, really, and end up with these things on my booth. So,
who was coming up to you? Was it younger guys? I've heard the legend of the Fairchild, or was it the older guys saying, oh, yes, you've nailed it, and this, you've got the important part?
Well, it was manufacturers, actually. I remember Van and Manley came up. There was a lot of the big manufacturers that sort of came up, and they were all sort of curious, and they were looking, because I had a few spare that people could look at, and they were all sort of saying, oh, well, do you mind if I just take this one back to the booth and I'll get back to you on it? I'm going, no, you can have a look at it here and you can leave it with me, please. So there was all sorts of that going on at the time. I was a bit green to it, if I'm honest. It was wonderful to be there, and it was a moment in my time with the development of this unit I'll never forget, really, because I knew actually that it was sort of cautiously being given a sort of thumbs up by other manufacturers, and that was what was key to me, really.
As much as other manufacturers will give you a thumbs up.
Yeah, well, exactly, they're all a bit sniffy, and you know, myself included, you know. But yeah, I mean, I'd sort of known a few of them really sort of beforehand as well. So a sort of manufacturer's chat and stuff. It was all in good humor, if I can put it like that. So yeah, it's good.
Since 2008, how many units have you actually shipped, sold?
Well, so I'm starting another one in, I've got two on the go at the moment. And these are stereo units. So I've built a number of 660s as well, which are, because the 670s were so popular, the 660s, which are the mono versions of it, didn't come along until sort of 4 or 5 years later, something like that. So in terms of quantity, I think I'm about to start my 56th unit, I think.
Okay.
Which, I mean, I look at this list of other manufacturers making the same unit, and I think, well, actually, it doesn't really sound that many, to be honest with you, in sort of like 15 or 16 or 17 years or whatever. But I think one of the key differences between my unit and all of these units along here is that it's the original wiring and it's the original circuitry, the original number of components, the original transformers, everything about it is exactly as was back in 1957 or whenever it was. So there have not been any changes. There's been nothing substituted in the circuit for anything. There's no solid state electronics. It's got the same number of tubes in it. It's got the same type of tubes in it. It's got everything. It's got the same meters in it. Everything. It's same controls on the front panel. It's got the original Davin 522G 600 ohm network attenuators on the front. So I've really tried to kind of stick with the original plan and do it that way. They are a good deal more expensive than a lot of the other ones. But I think, again, you know, it was just back to the way I sort of thought about things and sort of in the early days about, you know, if you're going to make it, just try and make it as good as you can and then let the people be the judge of it. And that's been my sort of philosophy, really.
So who are your customers then?
Well, so I'm so thrilled, actually, at the sort of the success of this unit. I mean, it's been sort of beyond my dreams, really. But so Metropolis Studios, they're a client. They've got one in their mastering room. Abbey Road have got one in their mastering rooms. Who else? Sterling Sound have got one. There's one at Sphere Studios, there's one at Ward Archer Studios in the States, quite a number in Europe now. There's quite a few in Japan as well. There's some in the Middle East. I mean, they're sort of dotted all over the place, really. But they're all sort of, I mean, every studio that has one is a flagship studio for me. I'm I'm absolutely delighted that they've, you know, they're able to sort of, you know, for me to be able to build one for them, that's a very special thing for me, really. There's quite a few big studios that have got them, which is great, of course, and absolutely fantastic. But there's also a lot of private studios that have got them. People that you would never think, you know, I get contacted all the time by people I've not heard of before saying I would just like one of these because I've heard so much about it. And I'm thinking, well, great, you know, that's the message, right? You know,
dare we broach the subject of cost, the pricing of the units?
That's always been the other Achilles heel, actually, is the cost of these things. Obviously, of all the sort of 7 or 8 other units I've mentioned, this is a sort of bit of a front runner in terms of cost. I will say that there is over 100 hours of build time per unit. If I was to put myself on an hourly rate, I'd probably be on like £10 an hour or something like that. You know, in reality.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, even though the cost is high, I don't sort of really factor myself in, but obviously I factor myself in as a business and being able to put food on the table and, you know, and pay the mortgage. But it's not like I'm going out to a job charging £150 an hour to repair something. It's not like that.
Ultimately, by the fact that you haven't given me a figure, can we say that it's unit?
I will tell you. I've been filibustering there for a bit, actually. So you'll have to excuse me. I'm just going to I am just going to check this actually right now, because I know they've gone up in price. But I think the new units now are if I get you back on the screen here, so the new units are approaching 17,000.
But, like, you know, it sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money, but isn't it an investment? Like, is there anybody who's going to have one who's going to, it's not going to be worth 17,000?
This is exactly what I'm saying, you know, and like I said earlier, you know, lots of people, particularly today, buy gear as an investment. It's an extraordinary thing with these vintage units, actually, the stereo ones. I saw one that went for sale for about $250,000 a few months ago in the States.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, I know. And I'm not quite sure what's going on there. It's a bit of a difficult one, really. I'm not, you know, that was one of the other reasons why I thought, you know, it'd be really nice to build these, to remake these units, because, you know, the old ones, well, very old then, you know, they work for long periods. They always have, you know, they work for long periods of time in the studio, you know.
This could be the last question. What is your opinion on plugins?
Well, you know what, Paul? Another very interesting question. So I do, contrary to popular belief, I do love plugins. And I think if you're not sure in terms of operation, functionality, Fairchilds, if you're not sure about them and how they work and what they do and how they should sound, the best thing to do is to go and get yourself a plugin. Just check it out. That is the best thing you can do to work your way around the nuts and bolts, the ins and outs of a Fairchild 660 and 670. And there's a lot of them about, and all of them really good. But there's one thing that plugins can't do, and that is capture random performance. A plugin will always give you a faithful, true replica consistently every time you switch it on. Every day, 365 days a year, for the rest of your life, it'll always do exactly the same thing. And the thing with tube equipment, any tube equipment, it's random. Its performance is random. The way it functions is random. It's just difficult. And for me, you know, the one thing that plugins do give you is obviously a sort of a form of consistency. And if you're unsure about something or how they work, or like how an EQ works or something like that, get yourself a plugin.
Yeah, that was the thing I was wondering. How close are they to, you know, a unit? Like, is there any real comparison? But I've never heard of Fairchild, but I've heard some of the plugins. You know, does that give me any information what a real Fairchild sounds like?
I think what plugins give you, apart from the sort of functionality sort of side of it, is that it's they're sort of one person's idea of how their Fairchild sounded. You know, it might sound different to another Fairchild, and that was always the thing. Every Fairchild was different. You know, you often hear people complaining about, oh, my, you know, this one's great from, you know, audio effects, but this one from somewhere else doesn't work properly, or it sounds okay, but just doesn't sound like the other one. And there are kind of little inconsistencies about all sorts of tube equipment, guitar amps that you buy, that even though they're the same make and model, do sound slightly different. That is one of the sort of the problems of a plugin, because it's just somebody's interpretation of what their plugins or what their real Fairchild sounded like.
So that's Simon Saywood's way to do it. Many thanks to Simon for taking the time to chat. Please visit www.geniusmove.ie to find out about audio courses to suit you. Thanks for listening. We'll